Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
All right, we are back. Now, joining us on the phone, we have the author of Reign of Injustice. We've got David M. Beers. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Yeah, I had to use your middle initial there because I noticed there's another David Beers that writes.
Yeah, I discovered that recently myself.
Yeah, it's fun. Yeah, there's another Al Warren, too, out there. He writes, he's a foot doctor. So I always get that mix up there. Foot doctor and murder, it's the same thing. So now, this is the first time you've been on this show, so maybe for listeners, who are you and what did you do before writing this book?
Well, early in my career, I worked as after I got out of the service, I was in the Marine Corps for 6 years, and then I became a member of the New York State Police, where I worked as a trooper and then later as an investigator. And I worked in several different capacities, narcotics, major crimes, violent felony warrants, and then I ended up in the forensics unit, you know, doing crime scene investigation. And when I left state service, the natural transition for me was to do the same type of work, only in the private sector. So I started doing criminal defense work. And I'd been working in that capacity for about 6 years when this particular case came along, the one that's the topic of my book. And so I worked, I was hired by Cal Harris through his attorney, Joe Colley. And initially it was a missing persons case. And it remained a missing persons case for about 4 years before Cal was eventually charged with murder, and then it was, of course, reclassified as a murder case. But what was unusual about it was that you know, Cal initially, when I was hired, he hadn't been charged with anything, so we weren't really entitled to any like discovery material or anything. So I was kind of working blind with a twofold objective: trying to find Michelle and also to develop information to create a defense for Cal should he be charged. So that was in September of 2001. In fact, his wife went missing just the day after 9/11, and I was hired a week later, and then I remained involved from that point on And what became interesting about the case is that it ends up getting prolonged for 15 years. He went on trial four different times over a period of 15 years, and he was convicted twice, both of which were overturned. Then there was a third trial, which was a mistrial, and eventually there was a fourth trial, and he was acquitted. It was just a story that needed to be told.
Yeah. I was going to – now, being a cop, a policeman, and going into investigating for a defense – was that a conflict of your, how do I say it? Like, it seems to me like cops, not in a bad way, but you're out there, trying to, catch the bad guy and solve crimes.
Yes.
So in essence, when you work for the defense, you're working for someone that's probably being accused or being charged with a crime. So isn't that kind of counter to what you're doing? I mean, does that cause a conflict in you?
No, for me, it did not. Not at all. And the reason, there's actually a reason for that with me. When I was with the state police, I was with them for, I joined in 77. And I don't know if you've heard of this, way out in California or not, but in the early 90s, There was a scandal in the New York State Police called the Troop C evidence tampering scandal, and I got caught up in that, and that's a whole other story in and of itself. But as a result, I ended up getting, even though I was initially cleared of any wrongdoing, I was charged with felony crimes associated with my work, and after a 2-year legal battle, I was exonerated of all the charges, but the damage was done, and so the police, they fired me. So I wasn't convicted of anything, so I transitioned all my training and experience into the private sector, and I didn't have a problem whatsoever in doing defense work, especially in light of what I had just gone through myself and defending myself. I realized that there's a need for that type of work.
Now this particular case, and that's the reason I'm going to bring up the next question. This particular case where he was tried four times for the same crime.
Right.
And there's a lot of talk of this, on radio shows and TV and all this sort of stuff, that that the prosecutors don't want to lose so badly, and it's not even about the crime, that once they get something in their mind, they're gonna take that all the way to the end, because it doesn't really matter what new evidence comes in. They're just so hung up on this person is guilty.
Yes.
So working on both sides, do you understand that? Do you believe that, sort of? Is there something to that?
Yeah. Yeah, I never really saw it that way when I was a police officer. It really wasn't until I started doing defense work that I realized that there were oftentimes another side to the story, and there were cases that I worked on where I felt that an injustice had been done and an innocent person had been charged. But when I was a police officer, I never saw it that way. I don't know, just you kind of look at things differently when you're a police officer. But after what happened to me, I started looking at things very conscientiously and objectively, and I started to realize that they do make mistakes, and they do try to maintain their convictions, especially if someone is comes back on appeal where there's new evidence. They just kind of ignore that and try to salvage their case any way they can.
Yeah, I it's kind of crazy because I've come across it myself in some of my research and writing about some police, and police that I really like too, having a definite opinion on something, and that's it, no matter what. They just hold on to it, and I could never quite understand that, because It's not that I'm thinking that they need to get a certain amount of convictions or any of this stuff like that, clear rates. It was just that they actually really believed wholeheartedly against some people that ended up not being true. And it's just,
yeah,
you know, it's kind of crazy. I'm not, because we're just all human. We all make mistakes. So,
yeah,
you know,
it's, now that was the case here to some degree, but there was other matters involved too. There was a conflict of interest by the lead investigator, which contributed to the way the investigation was conducted. The focus was on Cal Harris right from the get-go.
And I guess that's common. Like when you have a married couple and they're going through a divorce or just finished the divorce, that's kind of a common thing. If the wife goes missing or turns up dead somewhere down the road, it's kind of, you look at the husband, you look at maybe parents, brothers, you know, people closest. So that's not too unusual. This couple was actually divorced then when this happened.
No, they weren't. They were in the process of divorce.
Okay. And
it hadn't been finalized yet.
And you say that. So they were still living together and taking care of the kids.
They had four small children. They were still living in the same marital home, although, you know, his wife was sleeping downstairs. He was sleeping upstairs. But other than that, they were coexisting but mostly just for the benefit of the children until the divorce was final.
So, and now, were you able to find out about the area? Like, did the neighbors think they got along fine, or was there problems? Was there fights there a lot? How was their living situation?
Yeah, there was a lot of fighting, a lot of heated arguments, especially once his wife Michelle filed for divorce. There was a lot of heated arguments, and he was trying to do whatever he could to try to reconcile the marriage, but that wasn't working. But it did result in a lot of heated arguments, and it had been witnessed by several people, babysitters, coworkers. So, and family members. So, yeah, there was a history of a lot of heated arguments, but nobody was aware of anything physical that had happened.
Right. Yeah. But now she had taken on a new boyfriend, right? She was seeing someone new.
Yeah. She'd taken on a new boyfriend about 6 months before she disappeared. She'd actually met him at a bar. He was from Philadelphia. Him and his family he came up to the area to do some hunting, and it was just over the border in Pennsylvania. But they'd come into town to drink afterwards, and then she met him there, and they hit it off and started a relationship. He was like 12 years younger, and then eventually that relationship turned into a little more serious. They started meeting in the Poconos for some weekend rendezvous. And then by June of that year, he packed his bags and left his girlfriend, his family, his job in Philly, and moved to New York to be with Michelle, and found himself an apartment and a job, and started seeing her on a more regular basis.
Now, and if I understand right, she had worked the night she went missing, went for drinks, and then went to this boyfriend's place.
That's correct. And, she, yep.
Okay. Yeah, and I was going to say, and that's the last she was seen of.
Yeah, actually, so the boyfriend was the last one to see her alive, supposedly.
So now I'm just, of course, I've never been a cop, but my first thinking would be to check out that boyfriend as well as the husband. You know, ex-husband.
Sure.
Was he looked at all?
Not really. Not as thoroughly as he should have been. one of the key things that we argued was the fact that since he was the last one to see her alive, and it was only his word that she left when he said she did, you know, they never did a forensic exam of his house or his car or of his person. Even though they went over there and looked around a little bit with his permission, and the only thing they actually did to eliminate him was have him take a polygraph, which he passed.
Okay.
But other than that, you know, they really didn't follow through with a normal elimination protocol. And they found out later she had a relationship, another sexual relationship with one of her coworkers. And they never eliminated him properly either, other than the polygraph. So they just kind of abbreviated the elimination process, if you will.
Well, did they give the ex-husband or soon-to-be ex-husband a polygraph as well, or just those two?
Well, they asked him to, but his attorney wouldn't let him.
Okay.
At the time, so no.
Mm. Well, you know, I would think if this guy was serious enough to have left his girlfriend and moved to New York to be around her, he would be just as viable a candidate, because, you know, she's still living with the ex-husband or soon to be, and the kids, and that's got to be strenuous as well on him. So I would see them both being up for candidates for her going missing. But
yeah, absolutely, because he's certainly a significant other in her life, and he'd made sacrifices to come to New York to be with her, and he even loaned her $5,000 to help her make a down payment on a new home that he thought he would eventually be living in with her. So his expectations of how the relationship was going was much greater than hers. He had expectations of a marriage and living together, but Michelle's friends and family said no, it wasn't that serious. So there was a conflict there. So, but we were, you know, the defense was certainly looking at the boyfriend as a suspect early on.
Well, you know, I just find that curious, because if he's the last to see her, or, I mean, did he ever claim that she came over that night? Did he agree with that and that she left?
Yeah, he did agree with that. And there was actually, he said that she did come over that night. She came over, she got out of work around 9, had a drink with a coworker until about 9:15 or so, maybe 9:30, and then she left and went to the boyfriend's house, and getting there about 9:45. And then she stayed, and according to him, stayed till about 11:15, and he walked her out to her van, she got in, and he assumed she was on her way home.
Wow.
That was his story.
Yeah. Well, so we know she was there. And then now I found another part when I was reading. Now apparently Cal Harris got up the next morning and she wasn't around and he needed help with the kids. So he called this Thayer. Is that her name?
Yeah. Yeah, Barb Thayer was an adult babysitter.
And so when that Barb Thayer came down the driveway, she saw the wife's, Michelle's van sitting at the top of the driveway.
Yeah. And you got to understand, the driveway to their house is 1/4 mile long.
Okay.
And the road, the main road that goes by their house is just a dirt road, or at least it was at the time. So at the end of their driveway, you can't even see their house. But that's where Michelle's van was parked, with the nose into the driveway. So when Barb Thayer got there, she saw it and stopped, got out, looked through it. The doors were unlocked, so she looked through it, and thinking maybe Michelle was in there or sleeping it off or whatever. And but when she realized that nobody was there, she got back in her car and drove in to the house and then went in and talked to Cal and told him what she found.
Wow. See, that's interesting, too, because that would almost seemed like someone drove it there and left it.
Yeah, absolutely. The keys were still in it.
Right. So they would know where she lived, too. So that's another.
Yeah.
Well, that's crazy.
But the purse was missing.
Oh, well, of course.
Purse and jewelry, all that was missing, though.
Yeah, yeah. So now, what was it that the prosecutors or the police investigating, what was the actual piece of evidence or thing that made them focus on Cal and kind of drop the boyfriend and the squeeze at work?
Yeah, Well, initially it was Cal's character issues and his behavior afterwards. But when forensic investigators were looking through the house a few days later, they found some specks of blood on the garage floor and a little entryway just inside the kitchen area, leading from the garage. And they're really tiny. I mean, we're talking 1/8 of an inch at the most. But several different areas that they identified. And so they tested them initially, field tested them, and they came back positive for blood. And then they started taking pictures of them, and then they submitted them to the lab. And eventually they confirmed that the that at least some of the blood belonged to Michelle. But that was the extent of it. They brought in forensic experts from the Albany lab in New York and, treated the areas with fluorescein to see if they could enhance the blood because they thought it may have been cleaned up. But their enhancement techniques didn't produce anything. So other than those few specks of blood, that's all there was. And they knew that within the first couple of days. But Cal wasn't indicted for another 4 years. I think they had hoped that maybe Michelle would be found, but all of their search efforts, turned up nothing. So they decided for whatever reason to move forward with what little they had, and they indicted him 4 years later for murder.
So basically, they really had nothing but some of her blood.
And very, very little. We're talking, even the experts agreed that it was, 10 drops or less. So, there certainly wasn't enough to suggest that someone was seriously injured or killed. And then the other issue was the age of the blood, because the by the time the police got there, of course, the blood was dried and they took pictures of it. But otherwise, they didn't secure the blood from the original surfaces. All they had was photographs, and the photographs they took were lousy. Really lousy. They had troubles with flash and exposure, and so it was difficult to determine what the actual color was. So there was a big issue over the age of the blood, and because the first pictures they took were at least 4 days after Michelle was missing, and but later they got an expert to say it was just within a couple of days or a few days. But that was later. It was later decided that he couldn't say that because there was no scientific means to determine that. So our theory was that she'd been injured accidentally at some prior date and time, but nobody knew about it, and she bled on the floor and cleaned it up, and that's what they found. Because there was nothing to suggest that it was anything more than that. So that was the dissonance, the murder-assault theory versus the innocent explanation theory.
Well, what did they use? Like, they must have framed Cal Harris as something, evil or something gone wrong enough to where he wanted to kill his wife while the kids were at home sleeping and do something with the body and clean up or something all by morning. So what was it like? Did they say she was going to get money? Was she? What was the big catch to that?
Yeah, their theory that his motive was financial, that he was going to have to pay out big bucks because he owned a car dealership, so he was very wealthy, and their theory was that he feared losing the dealership or his wealth. To settle the divorce, and that was why he killed her. Their theory also was that he'd been planning it for months, likely from right after she filed for the divorce. but yet, the big problem with that theory was, why wouldn't if he planned this all out, why wouldn't he have included some type of alibi? But instead, he puts himself directly in a indefensible position where he had like 6 hours of opportunity to do the deed, because he's home alone with the kids from like 6:30 at night until 7 o'clock the next morning. And they, their theory was she came home at midnight and he killed her sometime right after she arrived and then cleaned it up, disposed of the body, and drove her car out to the end of the driveway and left it there. And
That seems strange. That seems
it is,
and that seems like an awful big effort. He would have had it all. He had to have it all planned and right down to I mean, because he did with the body, if it was like they said, it couldn't have been that far away.
No, like he had, like I said, they had about 250 acres of property,
right?
And most of it was densely covered with woods. There was a large lake there and a pond. Of course, they searched those thoroughly with every means available to them, and then came up empty. They had the forest rangers there and the divers and the dogs and the helicopter, you know, you name it. So they did a very thorough job searching, but came up with nothing. And he did own some ATVs, so he had the means available to him to transport a body out into the woods. But they covered the woods thoroughly and came up with nothing.
Yeah, that's crazy. Well, I mean, you know, I mean, anything's possible, right? I mean, but
yeah.
But you know, you kind of have to go with. So they actually took him to trial on that. Just kind of they framed him as a person that didn't want to lose money because of an ex and blah 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 and that, so that's kind of crazy. They were
claiming that he had control issues, you know, and he didn't like that she was that she had a boyfriend and she was out partying and that type of thing, and but the physical evidence they had was very, very weak at best, so they needed something more, so they threw in his character issues. Cal was very outspoken, arrogant, had anger issues. So they brought in all that negative, those negative character issues to throw in and try to convince the jury that, you know, this is a bad guy. And they did that very successfully.
Yeah. You know, it seems to be the way the world is right now, you know, the way it's going, you know, people love to jump on it, and it's easy to hate, much easier than to like.
Yeah.
It's crazy. So they actually convicted him two or three times, was it?
Two times. There was it was interesting the way it played out, because after the first conviction, of course, he'd been out on bail prior to that, so they took him into custody immediately, put him in jail. And within a couple of hours, the defense got a call from this new witness who revealed some crucial new evidence that no one was aware of at the time. And that was a turning point that led to the first conviction getting tossed out and granting him a second trial.
So what? The new evidence, was it something really substantial or
very substantial? Actually, it was an eyewitness who had actually seen Michelle at the foot of her driveway at around 6 a.m. that next morning, arguing with another man, not her husband. And also a vehicle that he described as a black or dark blue pickup truck. This happened to be it was a farmer. His name was Kevin Tubbs, and he was hauling a hay wagon up the road where the Harrises lived. And as he's going by the Harris driveway, he sees this pickup truck sticking out in the road at an angle. And he's got this 9 foot wide hay wagon he's trying to get by without slipping off into the ditch on the other side. So he said he was just creeping by. And as he's doing that, he looks over off his right front fender and he sees this young man in his 20s with dark hair and a woman that looked like Michelle Harris standing there. And it looked like she'd been crying. And then he just kind of continued on his way and didn't think much of it. But then when he was actually following the case in the newspaper when it went to trial, you know, years later.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promote for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And he realized that what he had seen was important. So he called the defense, Cal's attorney, and told him what happened. And so we met with him and went through the whole scenario. And so that was the new evidence that that led to the first conviction getting thrown out.
So were you able to place who that man with the pickup truck would be?
Yes. But the police were all over this. They knew that their conviction was in jeopardy. And so they were pulling out all the stops to try to discredit the new witness rather than investigate what he had seen. So it became my job to try to find out who this person was at the end of the driveway. And of course, my first thought was that it was the boyfriend,
right?
Because he fit the description, but he didn't own a vehicle that matched that description. And then I checked everything I could to find somebody that may have loaned him a vehicle or something that looked like that, and I couldn't find him. But then we had another witness call the defense, and provided some additional information about two men from Texas who had worked at this steel plant in Waverly, New York, not far from where Michelle worked, and they used to frequent the restaurant where she worked. And not long after she went missing, they went back to Texas. So we met with him and got that information and started to develop that. And as a result, we were able to identify who these two men were. And as it turned out, one of them, his name was Stacy Stewart, had actually been an early suspect in the police investigation. But the information that was in the police lead was very vague. So there wasn't a lot there to work with, but there was enough there to show that he fit the description of the man, and as well as he owned a truck that fit the description as well. So the red flags started popping up on Stacy Stewart, and I just kind of picked it up from there, and everything started falling into place. I went to where he used to work and talked to coworkers, and we subpoenaed his time cards and that type of thing, and just one thing led to another, and everything pointed to him. But the police had no interest in pursuing that information.
No, that brings me back to that. Why does that happen, in your opinion?
I don't know. I think, Alan, I think a lot of it has to do with pride, ego, reputations that were on the line. That they don't want to admit that they made a mistake or that they were wrong. Or probably more importantly, because it was discovered by someone other than themselves. They were really upset that this witness had gone to the defense first rather than
right.
them.
But I understand that, right? You know, and the pride thing and all that stuff. But
yeah.
you know, I think the reality is the majority of us in the public would like our cops better if they did make mistakes and did own up to it, because it makes them more human, because they're just human.
Yeah.
There's going to be problems. You can't expect them to be perfect. You want their integrity to be there, but, you know, perfection is just not something that, so I personally think I would appreciate it better if they said, oh, you know what? There is some other evidence. Maybe we weren't correct.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Well, that was my whole position. You know, they should have been more receptive to that. And if it turned out that somebody else did do it, I mean, what's wrong with admitting that, hey, we were wrong, and we're going to take care of this? I like you said, I think that would go a long ways to earn a little more respect amongst members of the community.
Well, yeah, because, if someone intentionally changes evidence and a cop does this under disguise and makes something fake to put someone away, that's one thing, right? That's bad.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, just to have a belief and you have a gut feeling, I mean, cops have gut feelings. That's what they do.
Yeah.
And to believe someone did it, that's fine. But if you make a mistake, well, it happens. You know,
yeah.
it's,
yeah, it does.
You know, maybe I'm just being naive and, you know, the perfect world and everything, but
yeah.
I think it would save a lot of these types of problems, you know, so.
Yeah, I agree.
So what happened? So, he had two of them thrown out, and what happened on the third trial?
Well, the second trial, even with the new witness, he was still convicted. They really went on the attack of the new witness, and he got him mad and angry, and he was pounding his fist. And so they ended up convicting him a second time. And this time he was sentenced to, 25 years to life in state prison. So off he went. And, he was in prison for about 3 years while the appeal was being written. And then, that conviction was overturned as well for some legal issues. So he was released from prison and came back and was granted a third trial, and this time in a new venue, fortunately, because the first two were in a small little town where everybody knew him and the fact that he'd been convicted once and twice. So they finally granted a change of venue and retried him in a third trial about 125 miles away up in Schoharie County, New York, which is up near Albany. And then that trial, by then he'd gotten a new attorney, a little more aggressive attorney. His name was Bruce Barquette from Long Island. And that trial went on for about 11 weeks. And then the jury deliberated for about 11 days and couldn't reach a verdict, even though the judge had sent him back in a couple of times to try and reach a verdict. They couldn't. They were pretty much split right down the middle. So that was a mistrial. So within a couple of days, the DA decided that he was going to move forward with a fourth trial, and that's what they did. Only this time the big difference, it was kind of a ballsy move, if you will, but Cal decided he wanted to go with a bench trial. where just the judge would be the sole trier of facts. And as it turned out, that was a wise decision. So the fourth trial was held, and in the end, the judge deliberated about 3 days and came back and found him not guilty.
Wow.
But a lot had happened in the interim of between the second and third trial, and then again between the third and fourth trial. There was an issue regarding new evidence that we found and new witnesses. And we had argued to allow what they call third-party culpability, where it suggested that someone other than Cal was responsible. And we'd asked to use that information in the third trial, but was denied. But then we renewed our request in the fourth trial, armed with some additional supporting evidence, and the judge granted it. So we were able to bring in some witnesses that supported third-party culpability relative to the men from Texas, and some additional evidence that we found. And I think that was kind of what pushed it over the edge for the judge to find him not guilty.
Wow. I was going to say, so out of these four trials in all these years, how's this affected Cal Harris' life?
It has turned it upside down. You know, he's still trying to get his business back. Yeah, but the one thing, you know, he had four small children at the time, and they're all adults now, and they're really they're very supportive of their dad. During the last two trials, they were there every day with him, sitting there watching the whole proceedings, and very supportive of him. They're all well-educated, polite young men and women, and so he did a nice job with his kids, despite the fact that he was in prison and had to have some help from family and friends. But yeah, it tore him apart. You know, he was yanked away like three different times from his kids. And,
and financially, it must have been brutal.
Oh, the financial burden was brutal. I mean, I have no clue what he ended up spending, but, I know just the work I did just as a private investigator was a lot. I can't even imagine what the attorney fees and expert fees and transportation fees and all that was. It had to be astronomical.
And who would have to take care of the kids when he was in prison?
He had an aunt. His aunt and her husband were the caretakers for the children. Made sure they lived with them and they got into school and that type of thing. And then they took him up to prison every weekend to see their dad. And so he stayed in touch with them on a regular basis. But his aunt and uncle were pretty instrumental in raising the kids for those 3 years he was in prison.
Hmm. Wow, that's incredible. So now he also got charged with some sort of other charge after. I saw that when researching the case.
Yeah. Well, that, as far as I know, that matter is still pending, and it's been years. So I don't know what the status of that is. It's almost like it... it gotten forgotten because it should have been gone through the court system by now. And the arresting officer in that case had worked on his murder case, but he since retired. So I don't know what's going to happen as a result of that. It was a alleged stalking case.
I got that, and I kind of thought, well, this is a really weird behavior. I read that he had drove up, and he was outside of this officer's house for an hour filming him and the kids and all this stuff. What was that all about? Did he have a problem with that officer? Was there some sort of thing going on?
Actually, no. Actually, there's more to the story than that. That's the version that gets released. But what had actually happened was... Cal was trying to sell a drone that he had owned, and he apparently he got information from someone up where this happened that they were interested in purchasing it. Personally, I think he might have been set up. But anyway, he goes up there to this address where he's supposed to meet this guy to sell him his drone, So he's sitting there waiting for this guy, and nobody shows up. As it turns out, it just happened to be right across the street from where this officer lived. Now that's Cal's story.
Yeah.
And of course, and then the officer sees him there and he reports it, and they end up having Cal arrested. And they impounded his car, and he had a dash cam on his car, on the dash, and they seized that. So you'd think if there was something incriminating there, they'd be using it against him. But I don't know what they have, because it was never disclosed. And like I said, that case that was over 2 years ago, and that's been.
Wow.
It just kind of disappeared. I don't know what's happened to it.
That's kind of crazy.
He does have some anger issues, and I can understand that. He went through a lot, and from something he didn't do. And, they pursued him, targeted him, hunted him down, and he endured this for 15 years. So I can understand why he's angry. But he has trouble. He has trouble controlling his anger.
Yeah, but that's interrupted his life and his kids' lives and everything, right? I mean, took a big chunk out of his life. So, do you know what his situation is like now? Is he like getting in with a new relationship or anything like that?
No, I really don't know. I don't touch base with him too often. You know, we're both on Facebook and that type of thing, but not too often. So I'm not sure what he's doing. I know he sold the house that he lived in and then bought a smaller house. But he's still in town. I've actually run into him on the golf course a couple of times. So he's still got his, circle of friends, the ones who stuck with him and didn't abandon him. There were some who did. And his kids are college age now. And as far as I know, they're doing well. So he seems to be pretty upbeat. But he still, like I say, still has anger issues. Sometimes he'll post things on his Facebook that are probably not in his best interest.
it's an open,
He vents a little bit. I can't blame him.
Well, So what was your putting you on the spot, what was your thought on this case? Like, what was your feeling that happened?
I was never convinced, even before the new witness came forward, that the Harris house was a crime scene. I just wasn't. You know, my background was in crime scene investigation, and what I was seeing certainly wasn't what I would expect to see at the scene of a bludgeoning homicide, as alleged. There just wasn't any blood. But there was two areas. There was an area on the garage floor, and there was an area inside the entryway into the house. And in between the two areas was like 6 feet. And there was no blood in that 6 foot span. But there was a couple of these dark brown rugs laying there. That's where the dog used to sleep, right there in the garage. And then they'd been there for years. You could tell by looking at the photos. They were worn and debris all over them and dog hair, but no blood. No blood. So I asked myself, how can that be? How does he get her? She's already bleeding in this entryway where they claimed he first attacked her and then carried or dragged her out into the garage. But how does he do that without leaving any blood in between? Or, even if he couldn't see it on the rug, why would he just leave the rugs there? And the same thing in the entryway. In the entryway, there was a small little throw rug. I mean, this entryway was, comparatively speaking, about the size of a shower stall. It was pretty small. So their theory was that he attacked her. He was waiting just inside. As soon as she walked through the door, he whacked her. So she would have crumpled right to the floor and started bleeding right on this carpet. But there was no passive dripping on the carpet or whatever. There was some specks of blood. But interestingly, the specks of blood were actually on the bottom of the rug. So it made no sense to me that that he would have picked up the rug to clean up the blood or on the perimeter of the tile, and then just turn the rug over upside down and put it back. It just made no sense. But anyway, I was certainly not convinced that it was a crime scene. But then when Kevin Tubbs came forward, and I identified Stacy Stewart and everything related to him, everything was pointing to him. And then we had a second witness that came forward, and he saw something very similar to Kevin Tubbs, totally independent of Kevin Tubbs. He was riding up the road with a companion, and he described basically the same thing Kevin Tubbs had seen, a guy and a woman arguing. In fact, he had his window down because his companion was smoking, and as he drove by, he heard the guy say, "Just get in the car. Just get in the damn car." But he said, "You know, it's none of my business." So he said, "I just assumed it was a couple fighting, and then I went on my way." But unfortunately, this man, even though I took a written statement from him and recorded the interview, he ended up dying on us before the trial.
Oh,
so now all of his information falls under the classification of hearsay.
Right.
So we weren't allowed to use any of it. But what he had done, unbeknownst to him, he had independently corroborated Kevin Tubbs and described the almost identical scenario.
Yeah.
So I was convinced that Kevin Tubbs was being truthful, which was corroborated by the second witness. His name was John Steele, and then when I started looking into Stacy Stewart, everything just started popping up. One of the interesting things was when he was first interviewed by the police, back when it first happened, within about a week after she disappeared, they'd gone to this steel plant to interview these guys. And he had told them that, you know, he hadn't seen Michelle Harris in a couple of weeks. But he also told them that when he went home that night after 9/11, he called his mother in Texas. And then the next morning, he went to work between 4 and 5 a.m. Well, his time cards, like everyone else who worked there, showed that they don't start work till 6 o'clock. So initially, that didn't mean much to me. And it didn't mean much to the state police because they thought she'd been killed around midnight. But now I'm looking at it and I'm saying, you know, why is he telling the police that he went to work at 4 or 5 when then they don't start till 6? So I started looking at him as a suspect that he was trying to alibi himself. Because when he was interviewed by the police, he wouldn't have known what they knew. And if he was the one at the end of the driveway and he sees this farmer coming up with a hay wagon and they made eye contact and he saw him, he's thinking, if the police know that, I he's got to come up with an excuse. So he tries to put himself at work at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And everybody I talked to, all of his coworkers, his supervisor, the safety director, they all said nobody ever came in to work that early.
Yeah.
If anything, he was late, they said.
Yeah.
And the other interesting thing was when they finally looked at Stacy's phone records, he had a cell phone when he was in New York. And now he'd been working in New York for about 6 months before this happened. He was a transient. They'd actually recruited him from a steel plant down in Texas, him and some other guys, because they were just starting up this new steel plant here in New York. So he'd been working there about 6 months. So he'd been in town since like April of 2001. But when you look at his cell phone records, Michelle went missing on the 12th of September. And his cell phone record showed him calling the steel plant on the 12th, 13th, and 14th. Never once before had he ever done that. So it never made any sense to me. Why would he be calling work if he was at work?
Right.
So it just made no sense. And then the office secretary there told me and the state police that she remembered him calling in sick around the time Michelle disappeared. She couldn't remember the exact days, but she knew he had because she took the calls. And but yet when you look at his time cards, there were no sick day entries made on that. And they were it was a brand new business. They were just starting up. So there were no punch cards there. It was all done on the honor system. They managed their own time.
Yeah.
So, you know, all of these things started popping up on me. And eventually I ended up, got the help of another PI that I'd worked with the state police, and he retired, and we got together and went to Texas a couple of times to talk to these guys. Every time we talked to them, they had different stories. Every time.
Yeah.
And they made stuff up. No. And then later, when Cal hired the new attorney from Long Island, he had his own investigative staff, and they kind of joined in, and they went down, they talked to him, and the same thing. Yeah, every time he'd come up with a new story. I felt so strong about what I'd learned from, about Stacy Stewart that I actually, talked about it with his attorney, with Cal's attorney, and they said, you know, I want to tell the state police about this to see if they'll take the lead on this and follow through with it. I said, I've taken it about as far as I can go without enforcement authority. So he said, well, you know these guys better than I do. How do you think they'll take it? And I said, well, it's just it. I don't. I said, you know, the fact that Cal's already be convicted, you know, they might just show me the door. But he says, I'll leave that up to you. He says, as long as you don't include anything about Cal and it's all about Stacy Stewart, I don't care if you talk to him. So I did. I went down and I talked to the lead investigators and laid out the whole thing, everything I knew about him. And it just fell on deaf ears. Hmm. They weren't interested. They pretended to be interested, but
well, of course, yeah, they'll save face.
Yeah.
Wow, quite a story.
That was troubling. That was troubling. That was very troubling to me because you know I'd worked with some of those same people. I knew most of the investigators and troopers on the detail, and this wasn't the state police that I knew, and I've worked on other defense cases both before and after that were investigated by the state police, and I never had an issue. But this case really jumped out at me, and I think a lot of it had to do with the conflict of interest by the lead investigator. It was a woman. Her name was Susan Mulvey. and her conflict was her father, and I found out this very inadvertently through Cal after he'd been indicted 4 years later. We were just talking, and during that conversation, we kind of put two and two together, and it come to find out that Sue Mulvey's father had actually worked for Cal Harris years past, and he had to fire him. And he said it didn't go well. So there was already some bad blood there.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, Mulvey didn't disclose that to anybody. And by the time we did learn about it, you know, the bell had been rung, so there wasn't much we could do about it.
Yeah, it's crazy. Crazy.
Yeah.
Oh, great story. Lots of twists and turns.
Yeah, for sure.
Recommend the book. Do you have a website as well people can go to if they
No, want not
to
yet.
Find
I'm developing one. Because what I want to do is when I first wrote the book, it was too big. I had some chapters in there that made for some real interesting reading as part of the story, but it was collateral and I really didn't need it to tell the story. But, I'd like to put those chapters on a website and make them available to readers, who are interested in learning more and make them, you know, available for free to read along with maybe some additional photos. So I'm working on a website to do that. But I also developed an email address specifically for the book, and that's davidmbeers.author@gmail.com. If anybody who reads the book, they got questions or comments or concerns, I'll entertain them the best I can. But it is an interesting book.
Yeah, certainly. I recommend it totally. We'll have the book linked up on the website so people can do one click when they're listening. So, again, the book's called Reign of Injustice, and the author is our guest, David M. Beers. Thank you for being here.
Well, you're welcome. Anytime.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.